Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Spring Semester 2019. Lecture 22, delivered on April 17, 2019. The title of this lecture is Asset Management and Cash Flow Analysis.
Tonight, Cash Flows and Sensitivity Analysis. Now, in this lecture, it kind of covers a bunch of territory. But there is an underlying not math. There's math in this, and it's really simple math. It's like Excel math. And on Monday, I will actually bring in an Excel sheet that I had prepared for our special delegations from ministries of finance in second world countries and in developing countries. I showed this to them. It's really broken down into simple parts. And it makes cash flow analysis really easy because it's just like, it's actually a PowerPoint slide, just a set of them that I did in Excel, and I put them into a PowerPoint so that you can just see line by line how you do a cash flow analysis. The basic part of it is pretty straightforward. It works like this. If I have, okay, I got one. Got a marker. Now, you might remember that free cash flow is going to be your revenues minus your costs minus that depreciation, which oftentimes is now hidden in the costs in income statements of companies. Okay? Then minus your interest expense. Times 1 minus the tax rate, the marginal tax rate of the company. That is, in accounting, that's what we call net income, that line right there. But depreciation isn't really a cost, so you have to add that back in. Well, if you're going to subtract it and then add it back in, why are you doing it in the first place? The reason is that even though depreciation doesn't really exist, it creates a very real tax benefit. And I'll explain that in a second. But then you have to take out the actual money that you spent, the capital expenditures, and you also have to take out the change in net working capital from the last year to this year. So in other words, in my business, I spend $257 for the physical materials for a work of art. I am not allowed to put that into my costs. I must put that into my inventory. And then when I sell it, I can move it to cost of goods sold. But the cost does not appear in the financial statements, in the income statement, because it has to be put in the inventory in current assets. Therefore, the only way that I can see as a financial analyst what the effect of that money was is to look at how my current assets changed for over the year. Now, and right here, the change in net working capital, delta NWC, is going to be the current year's net working capital, NWC sub T, minus the net working capital for the year before, NWC sub T minus 1. So in other words, this is current assets T minus current liabilities T, that gives you net working capital for sub T. And then you've got your current assets for the last year, so T minus 1, minus your current liabilities last year. That gives you net working capital, so T minus 1. That's that. You'll have a problem on the final that will ask this. Find me the free cash flow. You'll have a problem on the final. I'll tell you right now. It's simple math. Write the formula on your formula card. You get 2 for the final. Put it on one of them, and then you just put the numbers in where you see them. Monkey see, monkey do. Don't ever try to think if that's not what you need to do, ever in this life. Okay. And there's your free cash flow. Now, I'll get a little more detailed on Monday on this, but one thing I do want to bring up. Notice this piece right here. I subtract depreciation, but then I add it back. But actually, I'm going to be taking this, blowing this up. What I'm subtracting is depreciation times 1 minus the marginal tax rate. See, that times that. You remember the distributive property. And then I'm adding that back. So the overall effect of doing this two-step on depreciation is that if I take this and expand it, negative depreciation times 1 is negative depreciation. Negative depreciation times negative tax rate is plus that tax rate times the depreciation plus the depreciation from the second line. So this is the first line. This is the second line. If I take those two and add them up, what I get, the net effect, is the tax rate times depreciation. That last thing is called the tax shield, the depreciation tax shield. In other words, even though depreciation doesn't exist, it's not real, it creates a real net effect. So the more depreciation I have, the more it creates a phony effect almost. As a matter of fact, this was why you got, if you remember your dark days in accounting classes, you remember those accelerated depreciations where more of the depreciation happens at the beginning than in the back years? That's because this tax shield, the present value of the tax shield, is obviously going to be better if more of your benefit from it happens in the early years. On a practical level, too, when many years ago, when I was involved in these projects, low-income housing for the elderly projects, we would get all of these rich investors involved in these projects. Each one would put in an amount of money to get a unit of limited partnerships. And what they would do is essentially they would plunk down $50,000. Now, these projects we got grants from the states and the federal government. We got zero or low interest loans. And as long as we had money from investors, like $10 million, we would get these matching funds, grants, and low interest loans from the state and federal government. This was not in Illinois, although this was happening all over the country. I wasn't in Illinois. You see, these projects were an absolute disaster on paper. We would build these nice communities so that old people would have subsidized apartments. They were nice, walls nicely painted, good heating and air conditioning, nice carpets, nice place to sit, nice game room or a sitting room with everyone else. And we lost money hand over fist on these projects. And the investors just loved it. They were, when are we going to do another one of these? They were losing money. On paper, we were bleeding out every orifice of our bodies. But you see, these were rich people who were doctors, lawyers, accountants, dentists, architects, independent business people. Well, why would they love us and want to do these over and over again if $50,000 they each put in to a project that was losing its shirt? Well, there's one of the answers right there. You see, we were depreciating these. We had a special advantage. We were allowed to depreciate these couple of million dollar apartment complexes for old people, and we depreciated, and the depreciation went to our investors. We divided it up. You put in, it was $10 million, you put in $100,000, well, you get, put $100,000 of the $10 million of the depreciation shield. They got the shield. So that shielded their real income from their real jobs. Don't you see? Then, that was just one side of it. Then the other side of it, we were losing money. So their investments were falling in value. So they were taking capital losses. There was a second leg of the shield. Because these, for $50,000, in the first years of these projects, they were easily saving taxes of $18,000 a year, because this was deducted from their taxable income and their jobs. So that means that they didn't pay tax on money So essentially, they saved their tax bills. They saved $18,000 a year. Over the life of a project, we would clean them up, sell them off at the five-year point or something like that. By that time, they had put in $50,000, and they had paid probably about $200,000 less in federal and state taxes. So they were losing money. And, oh, you should have heard, these aren't good. They lose money. The media geniuses and these investment advisors, oh, you shouldn't do that because, I mean, they lose money. They're a ripoff. We got a couple of inquiries from official, attorneys general's offices and that kind of thing, and we explained, here's how it works. These are tax shelters. They're pure and simple tax shelters. Now, was what we were doing evil? Absolutely not. Because at the end of the day, I could walk into one of those communities and a lot of old people who would otherwise have been living in hovels and ghettos were living in nice places with locked doors, and they had pretty walls and windows, and they got to sit in rooms with other people in nice accommodations. So it benefited everyone what we were doing. And there is the math of it. It's so simple, it's ridiculous. You got the idea? So if you ever get a chance, if you ever say, well, this is just a tax shelter. Okay, and that's bad because if you can show me that no person benefits that really wouldn't have something otherwise, then I'd say I agree with you. But when it's something like this, where the end beneficiaries were old people who lived much better in their old age, yeah, it worked out very well. Okay, so anyway, there's the basic setup for a free cash flow. Now, the thing though is that it's nice to do a free cash flow. I don't recall whether I did one in this class or not, but I'll do a quick one tonight for you. The real thing, though, is projecting free cash flow so that I have the free cash flow of a company or a project over a period of years going out. And then I can take the present value, okay? So what essentially I'm saying is that the value of a company or the value of a project is going to be the sum from the current year happening out to infinity, And when I say infinity, really, we're talking maybe 10 years. Don't go out 20, 30, 50 years. Just get it out there far enough. So let me say, I'm going to put, let me take off that infinity sign and put N years. And you might want to call this, one of the terms we use is, that's called, the N is called our horizon. Our horizon. In other words, I hate saying this, and I've said it before. Madam, did you know that you're going to die someday? Yeah. I went to the doctor yesterday. Yeah, you know, my blood test came back. So he said, what would you like to talk about first? And I said, well, doctor, it hurts when I do this. And he said, well, don't do that, moron. And then he went on to explain to me that right now I have an 8% chance of having a fatal heart attack in the next year. That kind of focused things for me. So I went out and I got myself a cheeseburger. I'm good now. You know. Okay, so where the hell was it? Oh, your horizon is how far out. Do you really, really care what happens to humanity in 100 years? You're not going to be here, any of you. I mean, I don't. Do I care what happens tonight? Yeah, there better be leftovers in the refrigerator. Okay, so the horizon is like, for our purposes, look, you take the present value of something 20 years out there, you're probably going to get a few dollars, discounting back that far. So usually a horizon would be 5-10 years. My preference was always a 10-year horizon. And then I put some kind of residual value on the back of it. But anyway, the value was going to be the sum from now of the cash flow, the free cash flows, FCF, times 1 plus the discount rate to the negative T power. In other words, present value of the free cash flows. Free cash flows at time T times the discount rate time plus 1 to the negative T power. It's just present value calculation. Nothing hard about it. What is difficult, first and foremost, is what discount rate do we use? Now, capital asset pricing model gives us a way to find a discount rate. There's no question about that. You know, we did that. You've seen me do it in class. R sub F plus beta times the expected return to the market portfolio minus R sub F. The real problem there would be, what's our beta going to be? Well, for a company, it might have a beta. If it's a public company, it most likely will have a beta. At least after a few months, it should have a beta. As you saw, Lyft doesn't have a beta yet. Just not enough data for it. But the real problem would be, what beta do we use if the company has no beta? For example, if the company is private, what beta do we use if we're not talking about a company, but we're talking about the incremental cash flows for a project within a company? Okay, in either case, and I've said this and I'm just going to repeat it, our first refuge is to find comparables. Find a company that is public that does what this company or what this project does and use its beta. Ideally, you'd find a few companies, a handful of companies, and take the average of their betas. That is the comparables way. But the problem is, in a project, most likely you're taking a project because it's something that hasn't been done before. And that makes it really complicated because, obviously, that's where you're going to make your biggest profits, is off something that no one's done before. So you're not going to find any comps. I mean, you come to me, madam, and you say, I got a plan. I'm going to make this thing called T-shirts. Whoa, you are a rebel. You're not going to do that. But if you came to me and said, I'm going to take on a project that is going to, teleport people 50 miles. Now, there is something cool. So I go looking for comps, teleport. Nope, nothing like it. Well, here's a company that will shoot you out of a cannon, you know. And I suppose that company that may... Have you ever been on one of those slingshot rides where they, you know, take you down like this and then they release you, twang, like that? All right, yeah, I mean, I did that. And it was... I saw dead relatives. And, I mean, that was when I was passed out. Apparently, I blacked out 3 or 4 times, you know, and then I'd wake up drooling and all that. Okay, now, if you took the seatbelts off, that's kind of like a teleportation. You wondered where that was going, did you? Okay, so, but other than that, you know, there's nothing out there. There's no comps. And then it gets to be really, really difficult to find a discount rate that way. So what do we do in a situation like that? We start just, honest to God, we just start guessing. This is obviously risky. It's above 1. Is this, look at these companies that do risky things in technology. They're above 2, okay? This is about as risky as you can get. What's the worst, riskiest company we can find doing something completely radically new? Well, here's one that's got a, and it's got a beta of 4.24. Okay, so let's reach for 2.5, or 4.4, 4.24. Okay, let's reach to 4.5. Essentially, you just keep ratcheting, finding things that look less risky, and you keep working your way up until you've got the riskiest thing you can find in that industry sector, and then you go with that, add a little nudge to it. It's pure guesswork, but that's about what you can do. I mean, and then, of course, projecting free cash flows. And this is where it gets to be a pain in the butt. Projecting free cash flows is not... There are really detailed methods. And then there are really sloppy methods. And it's interesting that some of the sloppiest methods actually do almost as well as the detailed, you know, really, really careful, calculate hundreds and hundreds of number methods in some circumstances. Let me show you something here. I'm going to pull up a couple of different companies. And going to Edgar. Oh, for heaven's sakes. There. Company filing search. Let's look at an old, stable company like Kellogg. Now, even old, stable companies can give you surprises, and you have to understand behind the company. Technical analysis is nothing if you don't have some fundamental understanding. Now, there are a lot of analysts who would disagree. You need to know nothing about a company. As a matter of fact, they say it's better if you don't know anything about the company to do true technical analysis, because knowing about the company sneaks in biases, favorable, unfavorable, all that. Now, I'm not that way at all. And you'll see why here in a minute. Let's look at the interactive data, the 10K on Kellogg. You see, at the end of the day, right there, see that? I need the first line of free cash flow is essentially just net income from the accounting statements. It really isn't, but for as a first pass, as a dirty first pass, that's just my net income, which I've got right here for Kellogg. You will notice that the net income First things first, if I were to look at the revenues of Kellogg, I see that there was a dip in revenues in 2018, and then there was a recovery. The first thing that I would want to do, just as a first pass, is let me look at the net margin. 1,344 divided by 13,547,000,000. So I get a net margin of 9.9%. Okay. What was the net margin the year before? Well, that would be 1.2 billion, 1,254, divided by 12,854,000,000. Whoops. Now, I'm going to consider that year 16 was an outlier year. See how they got, something was going on there. Okay, I seem to see a very stable net income to revenue number. So if I were to project my revenues out, I could just take 9.8% of those, and I'd have a darn good estimate of net income. You follow me on that? If I can know project the revenues out year one, two, three, four, five, if I take 9.8% of that, that seems to be a stable net margin. I would know the first line of free cash flow. It's dirty as heck, but it actually is not bad when you have the stability you will have with a company like Kellogg. So in this case, the next thing that I would want to do is I would want to look at what has been Kellogg's growth rate. Now, here I could look at, okay, they had a negative growth rate in revenue from 16 to 17. That seems to be an outlier in itself. That, for an old, stable company, no, Kellogg is dying. It's going to end. It ain't going to make it. It's just going to be dead. Have you, sir, ever eaten cereal? You have. Do you have cereal at home now?
No.
Why?
I did not buy it.
You don't have any Kellogg's corn flakes?
No. Those are
no. The tall corn taste of Kellogg's golden flakes, it's corn that you can really trust, corn that really packs a punch. All American, tall American.
Is that their slogan?
That used to be.
Really?
40, 50 years ago. Bro, you weren't here when it was good. Now you live in an age of computers. You don't even remember McDonald's, their giant opera they did on TV. Oh, it was incredible. You're just sitting there and you're waiting for, oh, here comes a McDonald's commercial. Some guy's mopping a floor, and suddenly some other guy comes in and says, grab the bucket and mop, scrub the bottom and top. And then the kid says, tell me, what does it mean? And all these people walk out on the stage like in a New York play. At McDonald's, it's clean. And then they say, you deezer. It was just so inspiring for a fat little boy like me who ate Kellogg's corn flakes and ate McDonald's hamburgers. Okay, anyway, will you keep on focus here? Look, people eat cereal. Are you going to stop eating cereal, sir? Will there be a time when you will say, no, no more cereal for me? You know what? You'll eat cereal. It will change. It will no longer be that delicious stuff. It will be the stuff on the top shelf called Metamucil.
That's not cereal.
Well, no, Metamucil. What is it? Grape nuts. Yes. You know why they put it on the top shelf? Because they don't want to scare the kids. No, Mommy, I don't want that cereal. That makes me hurt. Okay. You see, the point I'm trying to make, though, is that Kellogg is not going to go away. Kellogg is going to slowly grow, and you're going to see more about that in a few minutes. I want to show you something interesting here in a minute. But I would say that the 17 to 18 is probably going to be a decent shot at a growth rate for revenues. So what I would do in a case like this is I would take the 547 divided by 12,854 minus 1. That's a 5.4% growth rate of revenue. Okay, you got a better number for it? Good. You don't. So what I can then do is I can say, well, and I mean, this is sloppy. This is so sloppy that, I mean, look. This is 2019 fiscal, and that was the 13,540. Okay. Revenue. So 13,547 Okay. Oops, I didn't want to do that at all. Okay, I wanted to format those cells so they're dollar amounts. Currency. Now watch. Okay, so now, over here, okay, so now we're going to say 5.4%. Okay. Net margin. I found, what was that net margin? About 9.8%. And now what we're going to do is we're just going to get those things nicely set up. And so this will equal this number times, open parenthesis, 1 plus your growth rate, and we'll make that an absolute number. Absolute reference. What? I2. Okay. Now we've got projected revenues. And then I'm going to do net margin. Equals that times 1 plus the net margin. I'm sorry, that's not net margin. That should be net income. I'll change that. Growth rate. And I'll make that an absolute reference. What am I doing wrong? Will you stop it? B2. Oh, not 1 plus. I didn't mean to do 1 plus. It's just a ratio. Sorry about that. I got my first line 5 years out. Okay? And then if I didn't want to go any further, in this case, what I would do for the discount rate for the present value, I could probably risk-free rate expected return to the market portfolio and then the beta. So, at the end of the day, is that right? Huh. Beta, okay. So, risk-free rate, let's take it 4.24%. Expected return to the market, 9.25%. And what's Kellogg's beta right now? It's probably about 0.7, something like that. Take it... Okay. It's kind of dull doing this, but 0.7, that's what I thought. The beta is 0.7. Oops, I didn't mean to do that. 0.7. So in other words, the K, my discount rate, is going to equal the risk-free rate plus beta times the expected return to the market minus the risk-free rate, close it. Is it really that hard for me to get everything to work? There, 7.74%. Okay, so that's my discount rate I'll use. And so the present value of net margin, if I were to stop there instead of doing the other lines, all it would be would equal PV, the rate, which would be the discount rate, the number of periods. Whoa, no, I can't do it that way. Excel doesn't like that. Excel doesn't like to have me sum it that way. Okay, present value of each one, that would equal that times 1 plus the discount rate, absolute reference, to the negative 0. Actually, I could do that simpler. I'm going to leave that there. I'm going to put in a line. Zero. And then just do this real quick. Now, I can put this up if you want me to. And then watch. I'm going to just take that to the power up there. Right there. Yeah. Okay. Sum. All you do there is just add these up. Equals sum. And so the present value of 5 years of projected cash flows is $5 billion. Yeah. That's how you do it. That's basically, I mean, I did it kind of fancy here. But see, by doing this here, I'm saving myself legwork down the road. Whoops. Again, by doing this the way I did it, then I can just change anything in here. I said, well, I don't like that growth rate. What happens if their growth rate is 5%? Well, what happens if their growth rate accelerates to 6%? Once I've got this set up, see how everything else fixes itself once you've got this in place? And I'll put up a little, like I said, I've got some... this Excel sheet, and I can also put up a PowerPoint. I've made up a little PowerPoint that actually takes some Excel sheets and puts them into a slide presentation. Now, as you know, I'm not a PowerPoint professor at all, but it helps so that you can take those and look at those in the leisure of your own flat and just say, oh, I see, this isn't that hard at all. The book seems to, for me, the book seems to make it harder than it really is, but that's just me sometimes. Okay, but anyway, that's where all this is going. A little bit of a side point here. Well, it's actually on the main line. And let me show you something else here. I'm going to take another company. Let me back up here. And let me show you Target. Target, you would treat just a little differently. Not a lot differently. You see, Target is getting into its more mature phase. So I would expect that growth rates would be stabilizing, net margins would be stabilizing, things like that, okay? So this is the best analysis. This is best used on companies that are a little more mature. So if I were to look at Target, the one thing that I would say about Target, do you see how I've got stable revenues? Not for 2 years, but I've got stable revenues going out over 3 years here. The more years you can get of revenues, the better. To do what I'm about to do. You see, because there will be sometimes when a year will be whacked. It will be out, just like you saw with Kellogg. 2016 was an anomalous year. At least it seems it was. So what I'm going to do here is I've got 3 years. So in this case, I can do a little bit broader growth rate of revenues. So in the case of this company, Target, I would take 75, 356 divided by 70, 271. And then I would take that number. This I would find the geometric mean. In other words, I would raise this one to the 1 over 2 power. See, in the 1 year, I did it, technically, I did Kellogg to the 1 over 1 because I had only 1 year, just the 1 year jump. Here I had a 2 years of jump, 17 to 18, 18 to 19. So I'm going to do 1 divided by 2, close the parenthesis, and subtract the 1. I screwed that up, didn't I? I saw it. Just as soon as I clicked, I was about to click and I couldn't stop myself. 356 divided by 70271 equals, now I'm going to raise that to the 0.5 power, 1 over 2, minus 1. By this method, I see that over a few more years than I had for Kellogg, Target is showing a relatively a steady growth rate in revenues of 3.55%. Okay? So in this case, in the Excel for Kellogg, I would put in a 3.55% growth rate. And over here, if I were to look at these numbers, let's see how stable this is. 69,414, 69,414 divided by 7,271. Why am I having such a hard time? Divided by 70,271. Oh, geez, I'm not finding net income. Phew. Boy, that had me panicking. Net earnings, sorry about that. Net earnings are up there, 2734. 2734 divided by 70271. 70271. What are you bitching about? Oh. Did you see that? Anyway, 2734. Do you notice how it waited until I'd wasted a lot of time before it let me know? Divided by 70271. So the net margin is, for 2 years back, was 3.9%. Okay? Now this year, let's look at it this year, just this previous year. The net margin was, keep that number, 3.9%. Okay, so this year it was 2937 divided by 75356. Look how stable that is. Do you see it? I mean, that net margin is staying almost dead on. So this would be a real good candidate for this real sloppy method, because my net income is staying dead on as a percent of growth. So in this case, I would put into that Excel sheet 75356. To start it off, 75356. Now, does anyone happen to remember what that growth rate was that I calculated? No, was that it? The growth rate, 3.55. Net margin is standing at, what was the net margin standing at? 3.9%. And the discount rate, based upon the beta of target, do you see how building that model is actually going to really help me now? Once you've done it, you can just put in numbers. The beta is 1.05. There it is. Is that right? No, something's wrong here. Something is really wrong here. Something is really... Do I have to put that in parentheses? Oh! I forgot to put the exponent. I forgot to put the exponent. That's why that's whacked. Okay, good thing I did that here. And that's also one thing about net income. Now I can get these fixed. There we go. So the present value of net earnings for Target is 14, just a little tiny bit north of $14 billion. Now I could actually divide that number. I mean, it's going to be wrong because I've got to do some other calculations. Divide that by the number of shares of Target that are outstanding, and I would have an estimate of what the price per share should be. You would really want to do the rest of that to get down to free cash flow. But once you get to free cash flow, you divide that number by the number of shares outstanding. That should be intrinsic value. You compare that. Now, again, though, you would need to do the rest of that. But right here, you've got the start of it, and also very nicely, you've got a model so that you can do this for any company. All you have to do is punch in the growth rate of revenue, the net margin, and from the CAPM, you can get this. I would recommend for right now, risk-free rate about 4.24, expected return to the market about 9.25. And the beta, you just get that from the market data. And once you get those numbers in there, the rest of it just falls in, one after the other. And this is what I'm doing with the delegations that are coming from these other countries. I've simplified it down so that they can do the calculations very quickly. Where their problem is, and I'll just give you the insight into how this is working. There are countries in West Africa, the Caribbean, and Central America that want to help their private industries grow. So they want to put money in these companies to see if they can help them get on their feet. The question is, what is the current value of those companies? And so this is the only way we can do it. It's by calculating free cash flow. Take that all back to the present, and we have an estimate of what these companies are worth. Then we say, okay, you put in $20 million in this company. How much more does that make the company worth than it was before? Then you find that tells you what your return on public investment is. And you can say yes or no to private investment companies that come to you wanting government money. That's how it works. This is what I'm doing for those people over there in international studies that are being brought in. One last part. It has to do with economics. Taking all of this stuff off the board for just a minute. It's still here, it's just that I've erased it so that I can show you something. Cycles of growth and decline. Companies are going to have their good periods and their bad periods. This is just the reality of business. Right now, we have been in an incredible growth period, one of the longest in American history. We are now reaching the top. We're going to teeter over into the downturn and the recession. And then we're going to go into a trough, and then we're going to go into the recovery and the expansion. This is how it works. Since the 1930s, when we started having active government policy, these cycles have been much tighter. The downstrokes have been much, much less. You see, before the era of Keynesian economics in politics, before the era of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, we would have recessions and depressions that would last years and years, in some cases decades. After we got to this point where we saw that government involvement should be done in 1932, we started doing that when we kicked the one group out of power. We've had these troughs have been much shorter, much tighter, and they have been much shallower. The data is there's no question. This is not an argument. The only way it's an argument is if they deny that reality is happening, which some people do these days. But anyway, what does this mean as far as business cycles and growth of revenues is concerned? Now, some of these actually might not make sense at first, but I'm going to give you in terms of sectors, where you see better performance as far as growth of revenues goes. Now, interestingly, down in the bottom of a recession, going toward the bottom, not at the trough, for some reason, companies in the financial sector seem to be the ones that do good. Now, at the just a few others along the way. In the early part of an expansion, companies that produce capital goods, factories, machines for industry, giant trucks, they seem to do pretty well. That's their era, that's their time for better growth in revenues. Coming up more, oddly enough, in the top of a recession, you will see consumer durables doing very well. You see, during the expansion, you buy all of the knickknacks, the trinkets, all the stuff like that. But after a while, you finish buying everything that is big, that is minor. You already bought that nice table for your kitchen. You already bought that new high-tech toilet. You already bought those beautiful windows with the light that shimmers through them in the stained glass. So now it's time that you can buy the really heavy stuff, the big, huge television that's 800 inches in diagonal, the stereo system that plays music so loudly that it shakes the sewer pipes down the street. You begin to get those really heavy. And then we teeter over into the recession. This is where consumer staples, companies that make consumer staples, basic goods, seem to do very well. Now, the logic of this is almost obvious. Sir, do you eat?
I do.
Good. Do you not eat if it's a recession?
No,
you still. I mean, do you stop using toilet paper? No. Let's hope not. You see, the thing, though, is that there are some things, relatively speaking, in terms of purchasing, you will slow down buying big-ticket items, but you will not slow down buying the basic staples of life, paper towels, toilet paper, basic foods, things like that. You'll still pay your electric bills. You'll still pay all that. So we know that in a relative manner, the companies that produce consumer staples will have their growth rates stay where they were, almost without question. So in other words, you have stability of growth rate for companies that are in. Just like, Kroger. Its growth rate is going to be stable because the same people are going to eat about as much cereal every year as they did in years past. By the way, I will show you on Monday a real example. I think it was Kellogg. Kellogg, a few years back, decided to take on a project, and we'll do the free cash flow of it, where they started the project of creating gluten-free breakfast food. And we'll see the actual thinking process that went through it. Now, I simplified the numbers some, but it was actually a real project. So are a couple others I'll do, too. There were a couple of companies that got involved in routers and Wi-Fis for the Internet of Things, which is just huge now. Those all your appliances that are tattling on you. And your Alexa, who acts like she's your friend, but I will not let her near my house because I know she's an axe murderess. She's going to kill me in my sleep some night. And she actually tries to make friends with my cats, and my cats know darn well something's wrong. Now, this just gives you an idea. When you are thinking, and this isn't just for free cash flow. This is for investment. I show the same thing in my 242 investments class. You think about the business cycle. For corporate finance, you think for things like estimating free cash flow, net present values, you think about it in terms of growth rates, stability, or cyclical variability. for investments, you think about how this, what this means for moving your portfolio around in, by sector at different parts of the business cycle. So, for example, right now, I would be, if I were a sector investor, I would be long in the consumer durable sector, the companies that make refrigerators, freezers, things like that, washing machines. Now, once it begins to teeter over, I will just move right to those low-beta consumer staples companies, Walmarts and Targets, companies that make bathroom tissue, make paper towels, companies that make food that we all eat, like cereals and basic meats and vegetables and pastas. So this gives you in this investment an idea, one plan. This is called sector investing, moving as the business cycle flows towards this sector or that sector. Now, there are other investing things, the passive buy and hold. There are other ones like what are called fad chasers. They will just run right to something that looks like it might be hot. Usually it's not, but if they do find one that is hot, they make more on that one than they lose on the ones that just fizzled out. There are all kinds, but if I were a sector investor, this is what I would think about. That's all I have for you. Go home.